For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So welcome, everyone. I'm very happy to have here tonight Professor Paul Kopp from the University of Chicago, professor of Buddhist studies. Paul has done really important work in studying the Buddhism of Tang period China in the 700s, 800s, 900s. Paul does research, amongst other things, in the manuscripts of the Dunhuang Caves on the from the Silk Road. So a wonderful record of old Chinese Buddhism, which he's worked with. He also works a lot with old ritual texts and relics. And also, Paul is a practitioner who's practiced and done sesshins here at Ancient Dragon and other places. So I'm very happy to have you here, Paul. You can just put this on.
Pleasure to be here. I feel like it's been a while. I don't know, after Zazen, it's hard to know what to say. What should we say? When Taigen asked me to, invited me to give the talk, I was, of course, very grateful to be invited, and he asked me what I would like to talk about, and since I'd been reading this commentary on a particular Buddhist text, I'll talk about it in a minute, with some students last quarter, and thinking about it, of course, I thought, well, I'll talk about that, because I wasn't sure what to talk about. And so I gave a little blurb, I think, which I think now has made its way around, and maybe some of you have read it and are expecting that talk. I won't give exactly that talk, whatever that talk was going to be, but I think I had advertised it as kind of a Zen reading of the I Ching's commentary on the Mahavairochana Sutra. So in a sense, yeah, that's what I'll be doing. That's what I'll be talking about tonight. But more like my own thoughts on reading, you know, I Ching, or part of I Ching's commentary on the Mahavairochana Sutra as a practitioner somewhat also. You know, I don't know how to separate out my mode as a Zen student and my mode as a professor. They seem to have gotten pretty hopelessly entangled over the years. I don't know how that happened. Anyway. So that text, I wanted to say, you know, I teach at this school that sort of prides itself on being a seminar school, right, and not a lecture school as much, and so I would certainly be, I'm more comfortable, I feel it's better to kind of get a conversation going, right? Get us a kind of seminar style thing going, rather than me just sort of holding forth, until they tell me to stop, which I'm certainly capable of doing, unfortunately. But so that's just a way of inviting you to please interrupt me whenever you'd like, you know, raise your hand or, you know, if I'm looking down, then just, you know, shout out or something. And at the end, I'm hoping to leave plenty of time for a conversation. So I have kind of three main points I want to make. Three main things I'd like to talk about. Riffs on my reading of this text. And I will make them in a fairly loose way, but I hope interesting way, to kind of, again, get a conversation going. You know, I don't know. It turns out I do know some of you. But most of you I don't know, and I really don't know, you know, kind of where you're coming from or where you are, as we say all these. So, you know, let me know, and I'll try to adjust as necessary when the time comes. So this text. It's called it's a commentary by a guy named I Ching, who you may have heard of. He's not particularly famous, I think, in the Western Buddhist world, but he was huge. Wrote work. I forget his dates, so I have them here: 683 to 927. Did most of his work, the kind of, you know, that we know him for, in the early decades of the 8th century. Buddhist monk, of course, but more than that, and in many ways most famous, or at least in some circles most famous, for being a mathematician, kind of, you know, of his period, a philosopher, you know, kind of proto-scientist, really. He's a fascinating guy, and I've been trying to get students over the years to work on him as a kind of, you know, as not just as a Buddhist monk and a Buddhist writer, although he certainly was that. That's mostly what I'll be talking about here. But, you know, him in full, and I don't feel qualified yet myself, because I'm not a historian of science, but if we can get a kind of historian of science and a historian of Buddhism together, you could really, we could really bring this guy to light. Certainly one of the great minds, I think, of the human history that we know about, anyway. There's certainly a lot we don't know about. He was first, I think that's true, a monk in the Chan tradition, what becomes the Zen tradition in China. He was in the lineage of what became called the Northern School, right? Lost out, as the story goes, to the Southern School of Huineng, who you may know, ancestor in many ways of what we do here. But he didn't seem to, and most of the people of this time didn't seem to be so, you know, limited in their schools. The schools, really, as we think of them now, really hadn't come to be yet. And so he was also, and is probably most famous for being the kind of co-translator and one of the main students of an Indian monk named Shubhakara Shimha, who was one of, I call him the Three Amigos, right? The three main guys who introduced what we call esoteric or tantric Buddhism into East Asia, and was involved in the translation of this text that I'll be mentioning here, the Mahavarochana Sutra. Mahavarochana, great, translated into Chinese as essentially the great sun, right? In Japanese Zen, you may have heard of him as Dainichi Nyorai, right? The great sun Buddha, essentially. Three main texts, not associated with three guys one to one, but one of the three main texts of what becomes this esoteric Buddhist tradition in East Asia. Difficult text in many ways, and so as these things go, I Ching and what seems to have happened is that Shubhakara Shimha gave lectures on this text, and I Ching wrote them down. And embellish them, kind of put them into better Chinese, probably. And so we have this text, which is the main way into this Mahavarochana Sutra that we have, and it's called, you know, basically the commentary on the Mahavarochana Sutra. And this is the text that I was reading with students over the last couple of months, as it's a kind of standard East Asian, or really just Buddhist commentary, that as it goes line by line, word by word through this text, and tries to explain everything in it. And basically kind of takes a text that's already very full of metaphors. I mean, the Buddha himself is called the Great Sun Buddha, right? And likened to what they call, and that's, you know, what I'm sure you're familiar with, the Dharma body, right? Meaning reality itself, understood as a kind of sacred substance, right? The body of the Buddha. Just backing up, I guess. Sometimes there are said to be three bodies of the Buddha. But if I say things that people already really know all too well, just throw something at me. But you often have three bodies of the Buddha in Buddhist doctrine, right? One called the sort of transformation Buddha, transformation body of the Buddha, and that's the usually said to be the historical Buddha, the Buddha as a human, you know, as he appeared in history as a human, as a guy who lived, was born, taught some things, and died, right? Then there's another body of the Buddha called the, in Sanskrit, right, one of the names is the Sambhogakaya. I think of this as the kind of the light show, the magic show, fireworks Buddha, right? And this is sometimes, I think Tagen mentioned Dunhuang, and if you've seen these beautiful cave murals there, they'll show these kind of amazing Buddha lands, right, with beings flying all around and light, made of light and color. The beings who appear in the sky and the beings of these pure lands, bodhisattvas and otherwise, and the Buddha of the pure land, that is the kind of Sambhogakaya, right, that magic show Buddha. The other one, the third one, Mahavarojana, right, is the Dharmakaya, right, the, in a sense, reality as such, right? Reality, the world as the Buddha as the world, right? So already that's a kind of a metaphor in the text. Mostly, I'm going to want to be talking about, you know, metaphors and how do we understand them? How do we think about them as we read Buddhist texts? And then what the I Ching commentary does, right? Instead of that, it kind of makes it more complicated, right? It makes it more complex by adding more metaphors, right? By kind of adding metaphors to metaphors. So when he talks about what is the nature, who is this guy, Mahavarojana, right? They will say, well, it's the body of the Buddha, right? It's the Dharmakaya, a body of reality, right? But then they'll say, he's the sun. And so what is the sun? And the text says, well, it's like the worldly sun, right? Because again, metaphors and analogies, again, what these texts are made out of again and again. It's like the sun of the world, the text says, right? But whereas in this, with the sun of the world, you know, it shines, but there's, you know, things can get in the way of sunlight, and then you have shade, right? You have dark areas, and you have sun, you have lit areas, and you have dark areas, right? That's the worldly sun. But Mahavarojana is not like that. The sun of the Buddha as sun, the sun body of the Buddha, how should we think of this, is such that, you know, it illuminates both the outside and the insides of things. The text goes on for a while describing that. And anyway, I don't want to go through these things too much, but as I was reading the text with students and thinking, as someone who tries to not just understand the histories of these texts and their kind of intellectual lineages, but also, you know, what they might mean and how might one use them. Doesn't sound like the right word. You can't help but noticing, right? And you probably notice the same thing, that these texts end up being nothing but proliferations of metaphors and analogies, right? One added on to the other. And this is especially, I think, true, or it's often said to be especially true, of these esoteric texts, right? So you see mandalas, right, filled with Buddhas, surrounded by other Buddhas or other bodhisattvas or other beings, and then you read commentaries on them and they tell you, well, this stands for this and that stands for this, and this is the embodiment of that, and this one's the embodiment of that, right? And these are all, in essence, I would say, it's kind of different ways of understanding reality as such, right? Reality that is as understood within Buddhism. So you have different, or let me say, so you have, but, let me say, you have different attitudes toward all of this, right? I think, you know, there's many different ways that one can kind of slice up Buddhism, right? Slice up the Buddhist teaching, slice up the tradition and the history. And one way I find useful is, you know, thinking about these kind, about metaphors, right? Or about analogies, or about positive statements about the nature of reality, right? Reality is like clarified butter. You know, this is something you find quite often in esoteric Buddhist texts. Clarified butter is like this. That is, and reality is like that too, right? What's clarified butter like? Well, it's kind of featureless, right? It's indistinguishable. Well, that's like reality, right? As understood by the Buddha. There are all the kinds of this versus that, you know, that's not there in melted butter, right? And so melted butter is a good analogy for the world understood by the Buddhists, right? So you get a lot of this. And again, as I said, I think it's fair to say some kinds of Buddhists, right, or some Buddhists on certain days, maybe it is, are really happy with that, and on other days, or other kinds of Buddhists are not so happy with that, right? And so I think, famously, we have, if we use this kind of Christian theological language, they'll call apophatic, right? People who say you cannot make positive statements about reality, right? Because they just won't work. None of them are going to work, right? And most famously in Buddhism, as you may know, or Mahayana Buddhism anyway, we have this great philosopher Nagarjuna, who wrote a book called The Verses on the Middle Way, or anyway, it's attributed to him, in which, you know, kind of relentlessly he goes through any possible way that you can talk about reality and says, no, that doesn't work, right? And so most famously, you have what's called the tetralemma, right, or the double dilemma, or whatever. You know, what can you say? How can you conceive of reality? Well, it's something like A, or it's not A, right? Or it's both A and not A, or it's neither A nor not A, right? And then those are an exhaustive array of the possibilities, and he says, well, it's none of those. None, right? And then, so then what do you do? And again, just kind of give me a little greatest hits of this kind of Buddhism. Probably the most famous of all cases like this is from the Vimalakirti Sutra, as some of you may know, right? One of my personal favorite. I don't want to go through the whole text, but you have, it kind of leads up to this famous debate between Vimalakirti, who's a lay Buddhist. In his own sutra, you know, he gets to have all the best lines, of course. And so he ends up with a debate against Manjushri, right, who is the, more often than not, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. And they just go at it, right? And, you know, from in some accountings of this debate, the ultimate moment is when Vimalakirti, I should know the line, but I'm forgetting it, he basically asks him, so, you know, what is real, right? And Vimalakirti famously answers, right, he doesn't say anything. A kind of, one way of thinking of it is a kind of cutting, like a Nagarjunian cutting away of everything, right? Refusal to engage in all of that, kind of conceptual proliferation, for example.
That's described as the thunderous silence.
The thunderous silence, right. Or the lion's roar, because immediately, right, it kind of gets put back into, you know, this this world of metaphor and analogy and all of that, you know, because you know, what else can we do? You have to say something, as they say, right, as the book title says. So there's that kind of Buddhism, right, or that, you know, those kind of days for Buddhists, right, where they don't want to engage, right, or they don't want to get caught up in it, and they want to say no, 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 right. But there are other days, right, and there are other kinds of Buddhists who very much take delight in making positive statements about the way things are, about reality, right? Reality is like clarified butter, for example. Or, you know, reality is like pure gold, right? Or reality is, you know, whatever. And it's the esoteric Buddhists, Mahavairojana Sutra, is very, very much in that mode, right? In that style. I don't want to say that school, you know, because that will really kind of give you the wrong picture about the way things are or were in the history. But, and I, you know, at least historically, Chan and Zen really come from that same kind of world. And this gets, which is not to say that there aren't moments when they aren't negating, of course, or when they're not saying, you know, be sophisticated about this, of course they are. But historically, both, and I think this is why I Ching was one reason why he must have been, you know, comfortable in both of these modes. They both come out of what's sometimes called the Tathagata Garba school or version movement in Mahayana Buddhism, right? Or the Buddha nature movement in Buddhist history, right? Or mind only in some ways, which, you know, are forms of Buddhism which are much more comfortable in making positive statements about using metaphors, right? Using analogies. So, for example, Tathagata Garba means, depending on who you ask, either womb of the Buddha or embryo of the Buddha, right? It can kind of go either way, interestingly. And originally this was just a, like, Buddha nature, right? Or I think Buddha nature, that image is easier to get a hold of. You know, by saying that everybody has the Buddha nature, right? Originally, so we understand, that was just a way of saying, a kind of an encouragement, right? You can do it, right? We can do it. You know, we can become, we can awaken, right? We can become Buddhas. We can, we can awaken as Buddhas. But more and more, as history went on, it became not a kind of encouragement toward a future state that you could attain, right? But a description of the way things already, always already are, right? Actually are. You already are. This Buddha nature movement eventually came around to saying, awakened, right? Things already are exactly the body of the Buddha, right? Things are the body of the Buddha if you can only see them correctly, right? And so in Zen, of course, as you will know better than I do, there's a lot of language of seeing the nature, right? You know, seeing the nature of things. That's what you're supposed to do. Because things, as they already are, according to these texts, these teachers, these teachings, you know, is fully awakened, fully real, right? So where am I in all this? But how do you understand all these different metaphors, right? Because at the same time, it's important to see, and, you know, Buddhists are always making it clear that although you can affirm the kind of marvelous actuality of things, to use the language of this tradition, you know, you can't get caught up in a kind of wrong-headed view of it, right? And so you get a lot of things that can be boiled down basically to, you know, you can't actually understand the way things are because they will always, because they escape grasp, right? They are ungraspable. Or they are unthinkable, right? And then light is shown onto the fact that these things are all just metaphors, right? Kind of arising and falling away in the teachings, right? One after the other. You know, you can't get caught up in one or the other. And important to see that they, I think, that they're all metaphors. This took me a while to understand this, to sort of see this, that emptiness, you know, I just thought emptiness. No, emptiness is not, you know, emptiness is just the core straight shooting, right? The core truth telling, you know, just telling it like it is about reality. But of course, emptiness is just a metaphor. And then I had this moment of kind of, wait a minute, you know, there are no ways of putting it that aren't just metaphors, right? That aren't just, well, just metaphors. I mean, I was trying to think of one on the train and then the cab, because I had a bad experience on the train today. Up here, are there any, you know, ways of putting things in Buddhism that aren't just metaphors, right? I don't know. Bukasi in Chinese, right? Unthinkable, right? Unconceivable. Maybe thinking or conception is not a metaphor. I don't know. Maybe it is. Someone who's more sophisticated in these things can tell me. Maybe that's just kind of a plain way of putting it, right? But pretty much everything else, that things are ungraspable, I mean, that's just a metaphor, right? That things are empty, right? That's just a metaphor. That things are the body of the Buddha, that's just a metaphor.
Zen has to do that with a shout, which I won't do, right?
Okay, yeah.
I've done sometimes.
The shout. Or the lion's roar of Vimalakirti, right? Silence, right? So there's the metaphor, and then there's the, I don't know, the way of getting beyond or something, the metaphor. I don't know.
Maybe the shout is...
So then when I'm thinking about how do you read Zen texts, Chan texts, right? And then how do you read esoteric Buddhist texts? This is maybe, you know, how I could make good a little bit on my advertisement for this talk, right? How a Zen student could be at home in reading esoteric Buddhist texts. Because if you've read esoteric or tantric Buddhist texts, boy, they can just, you know, they're kind of they wear their mythology, right? Their mythicness, you know, on their sleeve, as we say. They don't Well, it's just, you know, one story after another, one mythological story after another, one light show kind of story after another. In this text, this the Mahavarojana Sutra, you know, I Ching spends, you know, pages and pages and pages just talking about the beginning of the sutra, and the sutra begins it's a sutra, so it begins by describing the Buddha. The Buddha was someplace, right? And he was surrounded by certain kinds of students, and he's about to give his teaching, right? Well, you know, this whole quarter of reading in, you know, once a week for 2 hours a week, we never got past I Ching just talking about, you know, who was sitting around the Buddha, right? Because not only do you have a lot of kind of mythological figures, especially these people called, these beings called Vajras, right? Jingang. But you got a whole bunch of others. But he spends a lot of time going through each Vajra, right? A Vajra initially was a kind of a club, a stick, right? The weapon of Indra, the god Indra, but it gets metaphorized and philosophized and etcetera-ized until it becomes a metaphor for or an image of reality itself, right? Of emptiness, the adamantine or Vajra nature of reality, right? Which is the body of the Buddha, or which is clarified butter, which is another way, you know, another image of reality as such, right? And these Vajras, they each have a Vajra in their hand. That's why they're Vajras in the text, right? And there's a whole bunch of them, and they all have crazy names. And I Ching goes through each of their names and describes what those names mean, and it's just another kind of manifestation of the real, right? And according to Buddhism, of reality. You know, this is the Vajra who breaks through all of the obstructions to awakening, right? Or this Vajra is the Vajra of the fact that there are no obstructions to awakening. You know, there's just a lot of them. And he goes through each one of them, right? But the text just says they have Vajras in their hands. They're Vajradharas, right? They hold Vajra. That just means they hold Vajras in their hands. They hold sticks, clubs, scepters, whatever you want to call them. But I Ching says, and here's where I kind of perked up, he says those Vajras are seals, like, you know, stamp seals, not the animal seals. That would be something different. That would be a different kind of a picture of where the Buddha was. He's the Buddha down at the beach. How come the Buddha's never at the beach anyway? So they have a seal in their hand, and so I perked up, and during this, how much time? 15 minutes, great. So I perked up about seals because I have seals on the brain because I've been writing this book about this ritual text that centers on the making and use of these seals, stamp seals, to be used in Buddhist ritual, borrowed from Chinese stuff. I won't get into it unless, you know, questions you can ask me. But and so they all have seals in their hands, according to I Ching, because according to the sutra, they don't. They just have sticks in their hands. But I Ching says those, he likens them to, and you know, that's why I say, you know, it's analogy on top of analogy. You know, you got this stack of analogies and metaphors, and you want to explain it, and someone says, well, here's a metaphor to help you work. You know, just kind of throw it on top. You know, and after a while, you know, you're getting kind of overburdened by metaphors a little bit here, but this is kind of the nature of these texts, right? Or, you know, somebody help me and tell me that's not, that I'm just wrong-headed. I would be grateful, believe me. So, he says these are seals. And he doesn't just say they're any kind of seal, but they're Dharma seals, right? Or they are Buddha seals. This isn't how I was going to tie them to the Zen text, but here's another way I can tie them to the Zen text. Because, as you will know, I think, if you read Zen texts, and I assume you do, Chan texts, there's just seals everywhere in Chan texts, or the imagery of seals, right? For example, they will talk about the mind seal, right, in Zen texts, not just Zen texts, but in Zen texts too. Or they will talk about the, you know, when the student becomes like the teacher, right, then that person has gotten the mind seal, and they get the seal of approval, right, the inka, right, the inka in Chinese, right? Etc.
As an example, Sarah, could you turn the wrong two around to show them? It's a little dim, but on the left there's the Buddha Dharma Sangha, Buddha Dharma Sangha treasure seal, the round one. And then on the right is the seal, which is my way of confirming. So those are examples of seals.
Yeah. Thank you. And, I mean, that's great, because what I want to get to in a little bit is about how, you know, where these analogies come from and what does it say about how we try to understand the nature of things, right? You know, as human beings who live in the world and who live in cultures, you know, who are, you know, shaped within and by cultures and as cultures in some way, right? Or as practices, anyway. Let's just say, but the fact that you call that the treasure seal is great, because this idea of the treasure seal is also tremendously deep in Buddhist Buddhist literature of all kinds. So I'm just curious, just if I can ask you a question, as an image, right? And sticking, you know, we're talking about metaphors and analogies here. Does anyone know why? Because we don't live, I think, in a world that we're, you know, we have some seals, right, in these kinds of situations, but those aren't the normal situations, I think, in, at least in American life, right? But why? What would it be? What is it about a seal? Does anyone know that would lend itself so well to Buddhist teachings, right? Because it's just used everywhere. Does anyone know what the basic logic is? So you have a stamp, right? Any kind of stamp is, you have an image and you just hold it in your hand, you put some ink, you stamp it, right? You know, in my life as a kind of a bureaucrat at the university, I'm just often just a rubber stamp, right? But I'm not a seal. A seal is something a little bit different than a stamp. Do you know what, anybody know what the difference is? Yeah, please. It authenticates, right? Authentic. So, what about this authenticity, authentication? What is that? I mean, that's part of it, right? That's getting into it. But what's like the bait? There's some deep logic there, some deep idea there about what a seal is. Oh, sorry.
I'm far off, but does it have to do with the negative-positive relationship between the seal and then the ink,
yeah,
the empty space, or the field matter that then results in the line?
That could be. That sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty deep. But what I, you know, in the history of Europe, religious seals in European religion, there, that the negative positive is there. A lot is made of that. But I never see that mentioned in Buddhist seals or in mirrors, for example. You also get a lot of mirror imagery and metaphors in Buddhism, and they never talk about the fact that it's kind of flipped, right? I mean, interestingly, but that, I like that. But that's not what I was thinking. Anyway, I don't want to like be annoying here and just, but this idea of authenticity, right? Because a seal, I mean, I lived in Taiwan years ago, and I had a bank account in Taiwan, and the bank wouldn't let me get at my money, right, unless I used my seal. I had to have a seal made. I had to have a Chinese name, and I had to have a seal made, and I had to have that thing. It was a little piece of wood, right? And if I didn't have that thing, then I couldn't get me. I wasn't me, right? And if somebody stole my seal, they, in some way, they could be me, right? And so at least in terms of, as far as the bank was concerned, that seal was more me than me, right? That seal was me. There's this logic of identity in seals, which is, I think, where a lot of this authentication comes from, right? So, you know, in olden days, let me just say.
Still that way in Japan.
Still that way in Japan, for sure, and yeah. So if a, you know, if a king stamps, you know, the royal seal onto something, and then I, you know, gives that to me, and then I go out into the world, I have the power of the king, right there, or, you know, it's, or gives, you know, that's what sometimes happen in certain cultures, right? You actually, you know, hand over the seal, right? Or in battlefields, right? They have a very similar thing of tallies, right? Where you break these things, and, you know, because you want to make sure you're getting the, you're getting, you know, commands from the right person, right? Not from a trick from the other side. That could lead to bad things. So this idea that a seal is identical with, or bear, or anyway, is governed by this logic of identity. This was at the heart, I want to argue here, or assert anyway, I don't know how to make a full argument, but about what was going on with these things. So when you have the seal of the Buddha, you will talk about reality is stamped with the seal of the Dharma, right? Or the seal of the Buddha. You know, what does that mean? That, well, what it meant, as I read it, was that all things, phenomena, right, are, well, I'm just going to say it again, stamped with a, that doesn't, maybe this is how we don't do things. All things are characterized by the identity of the Dharma. That is, they are empty. They are conditioned. They arise according to conditions. You know all the different metaphors we have for understanding reality as it actually is, right? According to Buddhism, there's a famous one of the most, to my mind, most vivid and most interesting uses of this image. The imagery of seals is something called the ocean seal, right? The hyena. There's a samadhi that is just roughly speaking, right, a kind of state of consciousness, meditative state of consciousness, called the ocean seal samadhi. And that is described as if you see all of phenomena as if it's images reflected on a perfectly placid ocean, right? That's where the ocean part comes in. The ocean is so stilled through samadhi, right, through meditation, that everything, that becomes a kind of a mirror, right? And that reflects things as they actually are perfectly, right? And then it says that those images are stamped with the ocean. It's kind of a, what do you mean they're stamped with the ocean? Anyway, that's just go with it, right? That's the way the image is described. And what does that mean? As I understand it, what it means is that all things are identical with the ocean, right? And this goes back to a kind of image that one finds, it's usually said to have originated in a text called The Awakening of Faith, becomes tremendously influential in East Asian Buddhism, both in Chan and esoteric Buddhism and in everything. And one of its central images is of ocean and waves, right? And so you have all phenomena are like waves on the ocean, right? Each one is totally different. Let's just imagine that. And each one is impermanent, right? Because it's arising according to conditions, wind, whatever, moon, etc. And then it's falling away, right? Constantly. And that's an image of the phenomenal world, right? And so if you look at it from the perspective of waves, right, everything is totally different. You know, I'm not you, you're not me, we got a cup of coffee, we got a cup of water here, we got water in the cup and the water are different, etc. You know, phenomenal reality as we normally experience it. But all things are stamped with, that is identical with the ocean, right? That is to say that it's just water, right? It's just the ocean. So you can kind of change your perspective and see that all things are one, right? All things are kind of one mind or one taste or the one body of the Buddha, right? In this kind of image. So, you know, it's the kind of old duck-rabbit thing, right? Sometimes you look at it, it's a duck, sometimes you switch, it's a rabbit. You know, look at it from one way, you know, things are all just, you know, it's the pure difference, right? Everything is different according to conditions and rising and falling away according to conditions. I forget, was that rabbit or duck? But anyway, the other one is just ocean, right? You know, everything is the body of the Buddha, right? Everything is the one taste of the Dharma, etc. That's this idea that where in Awakening of Faith, they just talk about ocean and waves. In this imagery of ocean seal, they use this imagery of the seal, right? They say somehow, you know, they were in a culture that where they were just using seals all the time, and seals were people in some way, and seals were authenticating, you know, various kinds of things all the time. And so this was the kind of ready-to-hand imagery of or a language, right, that was there to be used and was used. Not just in talking about the nature of things, right, but also about talking about how people could attain to a proper understanding of the nature of things, all right, or become masters, right, or become Buddhas. So you get the seal of approval, right, or the mind seal is stamped into you, not me, but you guys, by the teacher, right? And this is one I really love, because in China, in Tang China, for example, and earlier, officers of state would wear seals at their sash. They would wear them at their belt, right? And this was a sign of a certain kind of status, but it was also a sign that they held that office, right? That marked them. That was an attribute of that office, right? And so there, you find if you're looking for seals, right? You find imagery and descriptions in Chan texts all the time, where some teacher wore the seal of the Buddha at his sash, right? So what does that mean? You know, in the language of, in the cultural language of the time, right, it meant that he was the Buddha, right? He was identical with the Buddha. He had attained to the status of the Buddha, right? Or of a Zen, a Chan master, a Zen master, which, as you know, according to the logic of, well, the mind seal, among others, means that he was Buddha, a Buddha, right? So let me just wrap it up a little bit here. So on the one hand, you can read these esoteric Buddhist texts and you think, my God, this is just crazy, right? I mean, this is all these metaphors and mythology and, you know, this means that and I don't know, right? And you think, oh boy, I'm going to go back to some good straight-talking Zen text, right? You know, where it's just, they just put it plainly. And boy, I just, it's like drinking some nice cool water, right? Instead of drinking clarified butter or something, which that's something I don't recommend. Like, you know, you have an ink painting like we have here. Very, you know, we think, clear, right? But really, right? I mean, really? You know, isn't it all, aren't Chan texts too, you know, in the same way? You know, different flavor, different, you know, spin or whatever, but just as much, you know, kind of metaphors on top of metaphors, on top of analogies all the way down, right? In a way. Because, right, if it's true, again, that reality is going to escape, there's a metaphor, right? It will escape your mind, right? Escape your thinking, escape your grasp. Then there's nothing, there's no other... there's no other way, is there, but all of that. Anyway, so these were some thoughts I had while reading esoteric. There's probably more I was going to say. I never turned my sheet around here, but I think I got the main ones. A certain kind of a way, anyway, I hope you will agree, or not be too dissatisfied with me, in which a Zen student can be at home, you know, in reading these... esoteric tantric texts, right? There's lots more ways one could say, but talking about, for example, who is this Mahavarojana guy, and doesn't he also show up in Chan texts all the time? He does. Anyway, I'm happy if you got anything out of that, or if, you know, and I'm certainly happy to have been here, and I'm glad for your attention, and thank you very much.
Comments, responses.
Right.
There's a lot of things to respond to. I mean, first, okay, so you're saying that religious texts of this sort are just sort of metaphor upon metaphor upon metaphor upon metaphor.
That's one way of looking at it.
I think, I don't know if it's, I mean,
you don't like it? Okay.
I don't like it.
Good.
You know, I mean, for one thing, I would ask, you know, so like, take the metaphor that we're probably most familiar with.
Right.
This thing is, like, don't confuse the finger with the moon.
Yeah.
Right? So in that metaphor, when we say, don't confuse the finger with the moon, that moon is not a moon. That moon is another finger.
Yeah.
And so it infinitely goes on. And so we just have this, right, this sort of sea of self-referentiality or whatever. So one of my issues is that is not, how does that differentiate, you know, in the religious sphere or spiritual sphere, or Buddhist sphere or whatever, from any other language? You know, is it a different problem or the same problem?
Sure.
And it seems to me that in, you know, these series of metaphors, you know, the thing with the seal, when you say the seal is a metaphor, you can say that, you know, describe something as shunya is a metaphor. We can say that to describe something as not having own being or being non-self is a metaphor. But it's a very different kind of metaphor than melted butter, right? Or purified butter. And it seems like one of the ways it functions,
yeah,
is to say, you know, if it is a metaphor, and I don't know if it makes sense, you know, when we say that talking about, you know, the sort of descriptions, say, of what those terms mean, is that a metaphor in the same way that an analogy is? I don't know. But even if it is, it kind of announces its, thing, you know, as something that's like, this could go on forever, so let's just stop right here, yeah. Right? And that's why you get these, like, things like, you know, the mind seal is the three marks of impermanence, emptiness, and suffering. Instead of the mind seal, you know, conveys that things are like melted heat. Does that make any sense? Do you get me?
No, I get you.
Feel me, man?
I don't want to get too into, I mean, we have linguists in the house, I believe,
yeah.
Help us with these things. I mean, there's certainly...
I think Neil's articulated what I was thinking, at least quite well. What I was trying to think was, while we were going through this, I was trying to process this, and like, I don't want to turn this into a UFC seminar here, but it'll, like, the way I was starting to think of it was, say, an epistemology, is it a coherence argument or a foundationalist argument? And that, I certainly don't have an answer to it. Foundationalist meaning it's like one thing. Whereas coherence is everything is put in terms of the other, but depending, there's no grounding on it, which causes the inconservability that I think you're referring to. Just a final thought on that, as for the analogies, with the possible exception of nominal experience, I think, yeah, could you make the argument that everything is an analogy?
No, I think so. I mean, that's... I don't want to get into... I didn't mean to... Well, I guess I inevitably would have brought it up, but, you know, there are metaphors, and then there are metaphors, right? There are ways of thinking about these things, and then there are other ways. And sure, you can certainly... There are lots of good ways and good reasons to make the distinction that you just made, right, as I understood it, and a couple of distinctions that you were making there, I think. But to me, it's helpful, or at least I'm thinking that it's helpful, and I understand, you know, certain kinds of Buddhist attitudes toward Buddhist teachings, right? I mean, going all the way, you know, found in a range of different traditions, right? Even say in the Lotus Sutra, right, where everything is an upaya, right? Everything is an expedient, right? A kind of one that should be treated in a certain way, right? And so, I think, and I, you know, please tell me if I'm wrong here, that something that one thing that Buddhist texts are again and again asking us to do is to, in fact, not make the distinction that you were just making, even though you were making it for very good reasons, right? And that, yeah, sure, in many ways, clarified butter and non-own being, right? These are different orders of things, right? But I think that a lot of Buddhist texts, right? A lot of Buddhists would ask, including, you know, even, I always go back to the Lotus Sutra because I think it's sort of a very straightforward and sort of not very sophisticated text, but then it ends up being incredibly sophisticated, I think, in saying that, well, everything is just a kind of self, or not self dissolving, but just dissolving finger pointing at the moon, right? And then the moon is, you know, like what you just said. So, I don't want to call it just as an analogy. Let's think of it as a game, right? So the game is, in part, as I understand it, to take everything, right? Anything that's possible to be said or thought as just a mode, a method that is works better or works well or less well to awaken you to a certain understanding of things, right? That's separate from any of those modes, right? And whether they're analogies or whether they're different orders of metaphors, etc. Am I making sense here?
Yeah.
There's a function to the metaphors.
There's an attitude toward them, right? Yeah, there's a way, there's an attitude toward them that sees them as functioning in a certain way, right? I'm thinking.
Is that contrary, though, to, I mean, is that attitude different than an attitude that, you know, says we're going to use all these things empirically, knowing that, I mean, that's not inconsistent with them not being taken as descriptive, ultimately, right? Which is the, I mean, which is, and in fact, that they can't be. So, I mean, it's not really contrary to that sort of apathetic, is that true?
Yeah, yeah.
At all. It's like saying, cool. I mean, it's kind of more like, you know, they know of black holes, right? Not because they can see black holes, right? But they can see, oh, the light waves are being banned by gravity because there's something really powerful out there. And so yeah. You know, I mean, in a way, so yeah, it's like everything that all these metaphors circle around winds up being quite like a black hole, right?
Well, that's why I didn't want to harden these two positions as an either or, right? But they're sort of. So I don't know if it's taking a kind of. I hate saying all this apophatic, cataphatic stuff, but you know, it's like taking the negative view toward the positive or something. But I don't know. Yeah, maybe you can rescue us from this. You had a question about that.
So, I really liked your talk, and the point you had made about the Vajradhara is something that hadn't crossed my mind yet.
Which point?
That there were a seal rather than.
Well, that's just what I Ching was saying.
Yeah.
I mean, in this text, that's his little side comment he makes.
Yeah. So, over the winter, I was reading this book called "Well Springs of the Great Perfection," and I don't read a lot of Tibetan Buddhist stuff. I don't know if this is sort of out of your sphere of focus.
I'm a professor. I'll fake it. Come on, I got some. That's what they pay me to do.
And it's sort of. It's about, I don't know how to pronounce it, Dzogchen?
Dzogchen.
Yeah. And it was so different from anything I've read because, first off, there's 300 pages of them certifying how they got what they're about to tell you, which is about a page long. And they say, you came from this Tirthan treasure revealer to the snowy land of Ladakh, and then, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it was more like a phone book than anything. But and then they go through, like, hundreds of figures. They'll say, like, well, Buddha Gupta said this, well, Jnana Sutra said this, and then blah, 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 and then lapis lazuli rained from the sky in the charnel ground where Buddha was riding on a chariot with eight heads in his hand, and, like,
right.
It's like, holy hell, look at that.
Yeah.
I tend to looking at a bookshelf. Tibetan books are about this thick, and Zen books are usually about that thick. Usually. You know, there's some bigger
ones.
That's
right. Choose wisely.
That's why I always do. That's why I gravitate to Zen. I was like, well, it'll be easier to read. But so my question was, you know, there's this really colorful sort of like, you have like the experience of taking acid when you read Wellsprings, and then you have like rehab when you're reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. How do you connect the like really colorful thing with the just this is it, nothing special? You know, to me that's really, and it's partially a question that I think Bill's speaking to add at the end.
Yeah, please.
To me it almost feels like, and this sometimes doesn't occur to me because Buddhism is such a sometimes heady but also like feeling thing, that all of these teachings are a moment in time. You know, the emptiness, the teaching of emptiness came from somewhere because of the causes and conditions. The Lotus Sutra came from somewhere because of the causes and conditions. And maybe each period required different trends. You know, sometimes people need incense and golden Buddhas, and sometimes people need black robes and nothing, being hit with a stick. So could that be sort of why there's this real, as time has gone on, you know, for 100 years, maybe one method of teaching was sort of prevalent, and then the five houses are disparaged, and then, you know, the Theravada goes out of favor. You know, is this, what would be your opinion on that?
Can
Can I just jump in first as an introduction to you, whatever you want to say? The mention of Dzogchen is particularly interesting in this context because we're going to be doing cultivating the empty field at Hangzhou for our practice period coming up. And particularly Hongzhe and the Silent Illumination teachings, the practice instructions, I say in the introduction to that, the experience that Hongzhe is talking about is very much like the experience of Dzogchen. And as I was translating that 30 years ago, I also went to the Dalai Lama teaching about Dzogchen, and it was like he was saying the thing I translated the night before, the difference being the devotional apparatus for packaging, which is, as you were describing, really elaborate in Nyingma and Dzogchen, as opposed to, you know, our relatively simple, although for some somewhat ornate, you know, services here. But the core of description of the experience is, I think, talking about very much the same thing. So it was interesting that you picked the Dzogchen text to talk about that. So that is just a for your comment.
Yeah. I think what you said was what Buddhism says, right? I mean, the idea of upaya, is, as I understand it, right, is that people get what they need, right? I mean, the Buddha, you know, there are some tellings where the Buddha doesn't really say anything, but everybody hears exactly what they need to hear, right? You know, or the flower. So that's the very logic of upaya in Buddhism, as I understand it. So yeah. Right, and then according to texts like, again, the Lotus Sutra, for example, though others, you know, everything really is an upaya, right? I don't know if that's coherence or foundationalism. The kind of foundational versus coherence that I guess that could map on to another way of slicing Buddhism up, you know. Okay. Yeah, please. Yeah. As long as you don't tell me I don't understand language or something.
This is the bare bones and fireworks. I think it's relevant. I don't know if there's necessarily a difference. I'm a little bit for that. Some of you know that I'm a linguistic anthropologist. I work in the Amazon. Long story short, I got a little bit nervous during a particular ritual once, and one of the other guys said, "What's the problem? It's just the spirit." You know, like maybe the fireworks are the normal part.
I mean, bare bones is a setup too, right? I mean, everything is a kind of a way of putting things, right?
We're a little over time, but this is having a call here. I want to take time. If anyone else has a comment or question, something they haven't touched on,
something easy this time.
A little bit different thing. How did the people of the time interact with this text? Was it mostly the devotional?
Mahavaratha Sutra.
Were they talking about like metaphors and metaphors? How did they interact with this text?
Yeah, well, that's
like inform their practice.
Yeah. That's the question. It's very hard to answer that question because what kind of evidence do we have for that? We have this commentary, and then we have sub-commentaries, really commentaries on the commentary, stretching all the way, you know, for hundreds of years afterward, including in Japan, where the text becomes especially important. And then we have a whole range of what are called sadhanas, right? Other kinds of ritual texts for the enactment, which can be just the recitation, or in part of the text, or branchings off of various pieces of the text, right, that became centers or side dishes in various kinds of rituals, right? So is there anything else? You could talk about the kind of philosophical elaborations that it influenced, right, or that went into it. But you know, I think the kind of what you're asking for is that, you know, how did individual people, what did they do? You know, we just don't know. Maybe they know for later periods in Japan. I just don't know that material, but yeah.